Mummy gives me one of her most infuriating wide-eyed looks. I know she's hiding something. I know it. But what? Oh, God. She's not in debt, is she? The idea hits me with sudden force. Has she bought so many stupid gadgets to sell that she owes QVC £1 million, maybe two? Stop it, Sylvie. Don't be ridiculous. But something else? Gambling. The thought comes to me in a flash. I remember Mummy blinking furiously in the kitchen when I just mentioned the play Dealer's Choice. Oh, God. Please don't say that's been her way of assuaging her grief. But no. Surely not. I can't picture Mummy gambling. Even when we went to Monte Carlo that time, she wasn't interested in the casino. She preferred drinking cocktails and eyeing up people on their boats. I take a gulp of champagne, my thoughts all over the place. Am I going to push it? Am I going to confront my mother at a reception honoring her dead husband? No. Clearly I am not. Well, it was a lovely ceremony, I say, retreating into platitude. Lovely. Mummy nods. Sinead Brooke looked older than I'd imagined, don't you agree? Or was it all that makeup she was wearing? We bitch happily about Sinead Brooke's makeup for a few minutes. Then Mummy's car arrives for her and she leaves. I look around for my family, who are all, including Dan, scoffing the mini eclairs. I gather them up and find the children's inflated disposable glove toys, which they've named Glovey and Glover, and which have obviously become their most precious, treasured friends. God knows what's going to happen when they burst this evening. Oh well, cross that bridge. Then it's time for goodbyes and thank yous, and I start to feel I've really had enough of this event. At last we emerge into the fresh air. I'm quite dazed, and my head is pounding. There were too many bright lights and voices and faces and memories, not to mention emotional encounters, not to mention mystery conversations involving £1 million, maybe two. We stand in the hospital forecourt for the longest time, wondering whether to go for a cup of tea or not, and looking cafes up on our phones, before Sue and Neville decide that, no, in fact they'll catch the earlier train to Leicester. So then we're into a round of hugs and future arrangements, and that takes forever too. When finally we pile into the car, I feel exhausted. But I'm wired too. I've been waiting to be alone with Dan. I need to get to the bottom of this. So, you had a nice long chat with my mother, I say lightly, as we pull up at some traffic lights. I thought I heard you talking about money.
Money? Dan gives me a quick, impenetrable glance.
No. You didn't talk about money at all?
Not at all.
Right, I say after a long pause. Must have made a mistake. I stare out at the windscreen, feeling a heaviness in my stomach. He's lying. Dan's actually lying to me. What do I do? Do I call him out? Do I say, well, guess what? I saw you saying £1 million, maybe two, and see what he says. No. Because, just no. If he wants to lie, he'll lie, even if I do throw £1 million, maybe two, at him. He'll say I misread his lips, or he'll say, oh, that, we were talking about the local council. He'll have some explanation, and then he'll be on his guard, and I'll feel even more desperate than before. I'm just quelling an urge to wail, oh, Dan, please tell me what's going on. When he wriggles in his seat and clears his throat and says, by the way, I'm having some old friends round, but I've arranged it for your Pilates night, so you won't be bored by us. He gives a short little laugh, which doesn't ring quite true, and I stare at him with fresh concern. The £1 million, maybe two, feel instantly less urgent. I'm now more perturbed by these old friends. What old friends? Don't worry, I say, attempting an easy tone. I'll cancel Pilates. I'd love to meet your old friends. Which old friends are these?
Oh, just friends, says Dan vaguely. From back in the day. You don't know them.
I don't know any of them.
I don't think so, no. What are their names?
Like I say, you don't know them.
Dan frowns into his mirror as he changes lanes.
Adrian, Jeremy. There was a whole bunch of us. We volunteered at the St. Philip's Garden.
Oh, right. I shoot him a savage smile.
The St. Philip's Garden.
Brilliant. What a super idea to invite them round after all this time. And I leave it a full 5 seconds before I add in my lightest tones.
And what about Mary? Did you ask her too?
Oh, yes, Dan says, still apparently preoccupied by the road.
Of course.
Of course, my savage smile gets even brighter.
Of course you invited Mary.
Why wouldn't you?
Of course he bloody did.
Chapter 11. This is officially a marital situation. And actually, I'm quite freaked out. In a way, I really didn't expect to be. I feel as though our whole marriage, I've been playing around with worries. They were amateur worries, mini worries. I used to sigh and roll my eyes and exclaim, I'm so stressed, without knowing what stressed really was. But now a real, genuine, scary worry is looming at me, like Everest. 10 days have passed since the hospital event. Things haven't got any better. And I can't sigh or roll my eyes or exclaim, I'm so stressed! Because they, I now realize, are things you do when you're not really worried. When you're really worried, you go silent and pick at your fingernails and forget to put your lipstick on. You stare at your husband and try to read his mind. You Google Mary Holland 100 times a day. Then you Google husband lying. What does it mean? Then you Google husband affair. How common? And you flinch at the answers you receive. God, I hate the internet. I especially hate the photo of Mary Holland that pops up every time I Google her. She looks like an angel. She's beautiful, successful, and basically perfect all round. She runs an environmental consultancy, and she's done a TED talk on emissions, and is on some House of Commons committee, and she's run the London Marathon 3 times. In all the photos I can find of her, she's wearing what look like eco-clothes, lots of natural linens and ethnic-looking cotton tops. She has clear pale skin and blunt yet gorgeous features and wavy dark hair. She's got rid of the frizz, which sits around her face in a pre-Raphaelite cloud. Dimples when she smiles, obviously, plus a single silver ring, which she does not wear on her left hand. Previously, I might have thought, well, she's not Dan's type. All his other exes are more like me, fine-featured, fairly conventional, and mostly blonde. But clearly, she is his type. Clearly, I know my husband far less well than I thought I did. He's into gardening. He has a bunch of old friends I've never heard of. He fancies dark-haired girls in eco-clothes. What else? Dan, meanwhile, seems to have no idea what I'm going through. He seems locked in his own little bubble, preoccupied and even snarly. So, last night I decided I had to take action. I had to break through this weird vibe between us. At supper, I produced notepads and paper and said, as brightly as I could, let's each choose a new hobby for next year. Then we'll compare and contrast. I thought it would be a fun thing to do. I thought it might trigger some light-hearted discussions or at least loosen the atmosphere. But it didn't work. Dan just scowled and said, "Geez, Sylvie, really? I'm knackered." Then he took his supper off to eat in front of the computer, which is something we really try not to do, because we've always said couples who don't eat together. Anyway, I don't often cry, but I did blink away a couple of tears, because he sounded so hostile, so impatient, so un-Dan-like. And now it's Friday, and we're having breakfast, and Dan's just told me he has to work all weekend. All weekend, I say before I can stop myself. I'm aware I sound plaintive, and even a bit whiny, which is something I always swore I'd never be. Huge project, Dan says, draining his coffee. I need all my wits to focus on it.
Is that the Limehouse one? I say, trying to show an interest. I'd love to see the drawings.
No, Dan shrugs on his jacket.
No, just no. Really charming, Dan.
Oh, and I've done an extra supermarket order, he adds, for this supper party I'm having on Tuesday.
Really? I peer at him in surprise. That's very forward-thinking of you.
It's all arriving on Monday,
he continues as though I haven't spoken.
I'll do the Ottolenghi lamb recipe. You know, the slow roast one with all the spices.
The slow roast Ottolenghi lamb? The recipe he rolls out for special occasions or when he wants to impress. And I know Tilda would say I'm overreacting, but I can't help it. My chest is burning with hurt. He hasn't got time to spend at home with his family, but he has got time to plan a menu and do an Ocado order and make slow roast Ottolenghi lamb.
That'll be nice. I try to sound pleasant. Quite a lot of effort, though, just for some old friends you haven't seen for ages.
It's no effort. His eyes are light and unreadable. See you later. He kisses me in a perfunctory way and heads to the door, just as Tessa comes charging in.
What's your wish? She says, holding a piece of paper up at him. What's your wish? Your wish, Daddy.
Oh, God. I've forgotten about that. The girl's homework task was all about wishes. Anna's began. My mummy's wishes, and I carefully spelled out world peace for her, rather than to know what the fuck is up with my husband.
What's your wish, Dan? I echo her. We're all waiting with bated breath.
And if there's a challenging, almost searing note in my voice, then so be it. Let him pick up on it any way he likes. Except let's be truthful. He won't pick up on it at all. He never picks up on searing notes and voices, nor sidelong glances, nor pointed pauses. It's all for my own benefit.
Dan takes a piece of paper and scans it briefly.
Oh, I see. Well, I wish... He stops as his phone buzzes, glances at it, then winces and shoves it away again. Usually I'd ask, what's wrong? But today there's no point. I know the reply I'd get. Nothing.
What is your wish, Daddy?
Demands Tessa.
What is your wish?
She's sitting at the kitchen table, pencil poised over her sheet.
I wish that I could... Dan speaks slowly, distractedly, as though his mind is grappling with some other far-off problem.
How do you spell could?
Asks Tessa promptly, and I spell it out because it's obvious Dan isn't paying attention. The morning sun is catching the fine lines etched around his eyes. His gaze is distant, and he looks almost bleak.
Could what?
Tessa is banging her pencil on her sheet.
Could what?
Escape.
Dan says, so absently that I wonder if he's even aware he's said it.
My stomach clenches in dismay.
Escape?
Escape?
Tessa surveys him, as though suspecting a grown-up joke.
You're not in a cage, Daddy. People who escape are in a cage.
Escape. Dan comes to and sees me staring at him.
Escape, he repeats in a more upbeat tone. Escape to the jungle and see the lions. I have to go.
That's a stupid wish,
Tessa calls after him as he disappears toward the front door.
Just write, see some lions, I tell Tessa, trying to stay calm, but my voice is shaky. My whole being is shaky.
Dan wants to escape. Well, thanks for the heads up. It's my turn to do the school run this morning, and I'm so preoccupied I drive the wrong way twice.
Why are we going this way, Mummy?
Says Tess, beadily from the back seat. It's nice to try different things, I say defensively. Otherwise, life gets boring. The minute the words are out of my mouth, I realize their ghastly significance. Is Dan trying different things? Is Mary a different thing? I don't quite know what's happened to me. I feel like a pinball machine. Suspicions and worries and theories are careering around my brain in a way they never have before. I trusted Dan. I knew Dan. We were us, solid.
So what's changed? Or am I inventing problems for myself? The idea hits me as I head into a snarl of traffic, all heading to school. It's entirely possible. Maybe I'm Othello, obsessing over a handkerchief. Dan is totally innocent, yet my irrational jealousy is an unstoppable force, and I'll only realize it in anguish once I've killed him, divorced him, and got the children and the house. It's the Wandsworth equivalent. My head is spinning more than ever. What would Tilda say? She'd say, focus on what you actually know. So, okay, here goes. I know that I encouraged Dan to be adventurous. Huge mistake. What was I thinking? I know that this woke something up inside him. I know that he's cooking Mary his flashiest lamb recipe and suggested that I be out of the house for the evening. I know he googled Mary Holland, husband. And, of course, now I know he wants to escape. It's more than a handkerchief, isn't it? Is it? I pause at a set of traffic lights, my heart thumping and my brows knotted. My hands are clenched around the wheel. My entire body is engaged in this mental process. Okay, here's the thing. I'm not saying I think he's having an affair. Yet. What I'm saying is, he's in that zone. He's primed. He's vulnerable. He may not even realize it himself, but he is.
Mummy! Mummy! The cars are hooting!
Suddenly I'm aware I'm being beeped. Shit. And trust Tessa to notice. Not me. I hastily move on, then start looking for a parking space. All thoughts of marriage temporarily swept from my head. Bloody London. It's impossible to park. It's impossible to do anything. Why are there so many people on the roads? What are they all doing? At last I find a spot, three streets away from the school, and hustle the girls along, trailing book bags, recorders, and gym kit. As I head through the playground, I wave and smile to various mums I know, all clustered in gossiping groups. They basically fall into three categories, the mums at school. There are the working mums, there are the at-home mums, and there are the exercise-is-their-work mums, who never wear anything except leggings and trainers. What are their marriages like? I find myself wondering, as I survey all the jolly, chatting faces. How many of them are hiding worries under their smiles?
Oh, Sylvie,
calls Jane Moffat, our class rep, as I pass by.
Can I put you down for a quiche for the year group picnic?
Sure, I say absently, before cursing myself. Quiches are vile. Why does anyone want quiche at a picnic anyway? It's impossible to eat. I'll email her later and suggest sushi instead, which has the advantage that no one expects you to make sushi. Tessa and Anna are already at the door of their classroom, which is on the ground floor and opens straight onto the playground. I head over and help them put gym kit bags onto pegs, book bags into the basket, and recorders onto the special recorder shelf.
Oh, Mrs. Winter, says Mrs. Pickford, their teacher. She's a gentle, kindly woman with graying hair cut in layers and a lot of waterfall cardigans in different colours. The girls have been telling us that you have a new snake in the family. How exciting!
Here's the thing about five-year-old children. They tell their teachers everything.
That's right, I try to look positive. We do indeed have a snake in the family. We were wondering if you might bring it in for show and tell. I'm sure the children would love to see... her, is it?
Maybe, I say after a pause. She's really more my husband's thing. He feeds her and everything.
I see, Mrs. Pickford nods. Well, perhaps you could ask him, she hesitates. I mean, it would be safe. Is it a safe snake?
I resist the temptation to answer.
No, it's a 10-foot lethal boa constrictor. That's why we have it in our family home.
Quite safe, I nod reassuringly.
Apparently it was a complete surprise, Mrs. Pickford adds, chattily. Tessa told us all that you were quite shocked. I don't know how I'd react if my husband brought home a snake out of the blue.
She gives a little laugh, and I know she's only making conversation, but I feel flicked on the raw.
Well, we have a very strong marriage, I say before I can stop myself. Very strong and happy. Very stable.
We're in a really good place, actually. We don't get rocked by stuff like snakes or other... I clear my throat. So, as I stop talking, I can see a slightly odd look on Mrs. Pickford's face. Oh, God, I am actually losing it.
Right, she says, her voice a little too bright. Well, let me know about the show and tell. Girls, say goodbye to Mummy.
I hug each of the girls in turn, then walk away, my mind churning. I smile and wave goodbye to the other mums, and I probably look relaxed and jolly, just like them. But inside, the tension is ratcheting up. What I really need right now is a distraction. Okay, Toby is definitely a distraction. When I arrive at work, he's already there, wandering round the hall, peering up the staircase, looking totally incongruous in his shabby black T-shirt. Thank God he's here. He's already cancelled on me twice, always with a good excuse, but still.
Hi, Toby,
I say, greeting him with a handshake, and just for a moment there's a weird little frisson between us. The last time I saw Toby, I was half naked, and I can tell he's remembering that, too, from the way his eyeballs are darting up and down. Then I see him gather himself, and the next instant he's making a valiant effort at saying, "Hello, Sylvie. Thank you so much for coming by. I usually take the stairs. Is that okay?" "No problem," he says, following me up the staircase two steps at a time. "This place is mad. All those suits of armor. They're great, aren't they?" I nod. "You should see the basement. You know, I never knew about this place," Toby continues blithely. "Never even heard of it. I've probably walked past a million times, but I've never noticed it. My friends have never noticed it. Like, literally, I didn't know it existed. If you said Willoughby House to me, I'd be like, 'What's that?'"
Does he have to sound quite so emphatic?
Thank God neither Robert nor Mrs. Kendrick is in earshot. And also, thank God we've already commissioned a big Willoughby House Museum sign for the exterior of the house. It's going to be grey-painted wood and very tasteful. And it only took us a week of solid discussion to nail Mrs. Kendrick on the style and font. How are we ever going to agree on a whole website redesign? No, don't think like that. Be positive. "I'm sure your mum must have mentioned this place to you a few times," I suggest. "Tilda's been to loads of events here. She's very loyal."
"Yeah, maybe she has," he says agreeably. "But it never stuck in my mind. It's not famous, is it? It's not like the V&A.
Right, I try to find a smile. "Well, that's the trouble. That's the problem we're trying to solve. Clarissa's out this morning and Robert hasn't shown up either, so we have the office to ourselves." I show Toby our homepage saying, "Apply in writing," and he bursts into laughter.
"I love that," he says about 50 times. "I love that. That is so cool."
He takes a photo of the homepage and shares it with all his techie friends and reads me out all the comments, which instantly stream in. And I'm torn between feeling pride that we have something so distinctive and embarrassment that a whole group of tech whizzes are laughing at us. "Anyway," I say at last, "as you see, we're behind the times. We can't carry on like this, so what can we do? What are the possibilities?"
"Well," says Toby vaguely, still laughing at some comment on his phone, "there are loads. Depends what you want to achieve, like manage a database, an interactive experience, an e-shop. What?"
"I don't know," I say, my appetite whetted. "Show me."
"I looked at a few museum websites," he says, getting out his laptop, "like globally. It was pretty interesting."
He starts loading up websites, one after another. I thought I'd done my research pretty well, but some of these I missed. And they're amazing. There are photos that spring to life. 360-degree videos, interactive apps, spectacular graphics, celebrity audio tours.
"Like I say," Toby concludes, "the sky's the limit. You can have anything you want. Depends on what you want, what your priorities are. Oh, and budget," he adds as an afterthought.
Budget. I should have started with budget. "Right," I wrench my gaze away from the website of an American museum, which has extraordinary 3D photos of exhibits spinning slowly round on the screen. They're so vivid, that you really feel you're there in the room with them. Imagine if we could do that.
So, like, how much would that one have cost?
Actually, I read about that one in a tech magazine, Toby says, nodding. It was $500,000.
Oh, don't worry, he adds at my expression. Not pounds. Dollars.
$500,000? I feel like he's punched me in the chest.
But that was, like, with a whole big rebrand and everything, he adds hastily. Like I say, it depends what you want.
I feel betrayed. All I've seen online are adverts saying how cheap and easy it is to make websites.
I thought these days you could make websites in your bedroom for half nothing, I say almost accusingly.
I thought that was the whole point.
You can, Toby nods earnestly.
Totally. But they won't work like that one does. You don't need to spend $500,000, though.
He's obviously trying to sound reassuring.
You could spend $100,000, $50,000, $10,000, $1,000.
His eyes drift back to our homepage again. I mean, this is cool, he says.
Just a drawing. It's subversive.
Mrs. Kendrick, subversive.
I'd laugh if I weren't still poleaxed by $500,000.
Maybe it is, I sigh. But it doesn't bring in any customers. It doesn't make any money.
So how do you get customers?
Lots of ways. Little adverts here and there. Or word of mouth.
Oh, word of mouth. Toby perks up. That's the holy grail. That's what you want.
Yes, but there aren't enough words or mouths. I look at the American website longingly for a few more moments. So basically we need money in order to afford the website, which we need to make money.
Golden goose, Toby nods sagely. No, I mean chicken and egg. So, did you think about a platform yet?
I rub my face, feeling my energy ebbing away. Why is it that everything in life is just a bit harder than you think it'll be? Icing cakes, having children, keeping marriages together, saving museums, building websites. All hard. The only thing that's ever turned out easier than I expected was my Italian final exam. Oh, and lasering my legs. That was a doddle. I think I'd better put a budget together, I say at last. Then we can talk about platforms or whatever. Put a budget together? It's such a euphemism. It sounds as if I just need to collect the bits together from where they've been scattered and assemble them.
But I don't have any bits.
I have nothing. It crosses my mind that we could sell off some pieces of art. But would Mrs. Kendrick ever agree to that?
Sure thing, Sylvie. Whenever you're ready, says Toby, and a wave of sympathy passes over his face. It's tough, isn't it? He adds, suddenly sounding more serious, as if he gets it.
Well, of course he gets it. He's trying to launch a startup. He's got enough struggles and obstacles of his own. I give him a wry smile in return and shut his laptop. Yes. Yes, it is. It's all pretty tough. Chapter 12. It's all pretty tough. And it hasn't got any easier. It's the following Tuesday, and the most positive development in my life right now is the Willoughby House Museum sign, which arrived yesterday and is gorgeous. Far better than we expected. We all keep going outside to gaze adoringly at it, and the volunteers are convinced it's bringing in more visitors already. And even Robert gave a kind of impressed grunt when he saw it. But at home, forget it. I'm not sure who's most stressed out right now, me or Dan. He's permanently taut, stroppy, tentery, and generally hard to live with. When his phone rings, he grabs for it so fast it makes me wince. I've got home twice to find him striding around the kitchen, having intense phone conversations, which he immediately breaks off from. And when I ask, "What was that?" he replies,
"Nothing,"
in discouraging tones, as though I'm somehow trespassing on his privacy. Whereupon I feel such a surge of frustration that I want to hit something. I feel as if I don't know anything anymore. I don't know what Dan's thinking. I don't know what he wants. I still don't know what this £1 million maybe two is. I don't know why he's been huddling with my mother. If it was to arrange a surprise, then where is that surprise? I used to think our marriage was a solid entity, firm and dense, with maybe just the odd little fault line. But are those fault lines bigger than I thought? Are they chasms? And if so, why can't I see them? Sometimes, honestly and truly, I feel like a colorblind person. It's as if everyone else can see something I can't. Even Mummy. Sometimes she takes a breath to speak, then stops herself and says, "Oh, I've lost my train of thought," in an unconvincing way. And her eyes slide away from mine, and I think, "What? What?" On the other hand, I may be going paranoid. It's possible. I could really do with a sensible friend to talk to, but the only person who knows all the ins and outs is Tilda, and she's still commuting to Andover. Yesterday I felt so desperate I found myself Googling, "How to keep your husband," and the answer that came back was essentially, "You can't. If he wants to leave you, he will." I hate the internet. The infamous dinner party is tonight, and Dan is totally obsessed about the food, the wine, even the coffee cups. When has he ever taken any notice of coffee cups? Meanwhile, I'm ratty and snappy and dying for the whole thing to be over. I keep telling myself, it can't be that bad. Then, yes, it can. And then, actually, it can be worse. I'm not sure what worse might consist of, but it won't be good, surely. Dan's picked up on my tension. How could he not? Although, silver lining, I've blamed it on my problems at work, which are still massive despite the sign. My non-existent website budget is still non-existent. I've made approaches to every single supporter, patron, and philanthropist I can think of. But so far, we've received nothing except £100 in cash, pushed anonymously through the letterbox in an envelope, I totally suspect Mrs. Kendrick, and a big crate of Fortnum's biscuits. One of our volunteers apparently pulled some strings. Robert's face when he saw them was quite funny. In fact, it's the only thing I've laughed at for ages. And now I've got to get ready to confront my nemesis over Ottolenghi slow-cooked lamb. No, I don't have any proof she's my nemesis. I have to remember this. As I enter the kitchen, I'm wearing my most casually elegant outfit, slim white trousers and a print top with a flash of cleavage, and wafting perfume. I'm hoping Dan will turn from the stove, and his eyes will light up, and maybe we'll sink into each other's arms in a bonding, imprinting way, which will inoculate him against Mary. But he's not by the stove. I can see him through the window, out in the garden, picking some mint from our straggly bush, which grows by one of the Wendy houses. I do know mint. Mint and rosemary. Any other herbs? Forget it. I'd need to see them in a Tesco packet to identify them. I head through the back door and make my way over our crappy grass, picking my brain for something to say. As I reach him, I blurt out, "Mint is lovely, isn't it?" Which is such a bland comment, I instantly regret it. But then, I'm not sure Dan even heard. He's rubbing a mint leaf in his fingers, and his eyes have got that faraway look again. Where is he now? Back in his youth? With her? And yet again, I feel a stab of anxiety. Okay, I have no proof of anything, but that's not the point. The point is, Dan is vulnerable. I believe it more than ever. Something happened in that garden. Something was stirred up in him. And now this woman is going to arrive, and if she's anything like she looks in her photo, still be totally gorgeous, and remind him of how it all used to be before marriage and kids and stretch marks. I mean, she might have stretch marks, but I doubt it. I help Dan gather some more mint, and we head back inside, and somehow I keep making innocuous conversation, but my mind is whirring. "So, tell me about your friends," I say as he washes the mint. "Tell me about..." I make a heroic effort to sound casual. "Mary." "Well, I haven't seen Jeremy or Adrian for years," Dan says, and my brain gives a squeal of frustration. "I don't want to know about bloody Jeremy or Adrian. Didn't you hear me say Mary? Mary?" "Jeremy's in tax law, as far as I know," Dan continues. and Adrian's in teaching, I think. But it wasn't clear on LinkedIn. My brain tunes out as he tells me all about Jeremy and Adrian and how much fun they used to be and the walk they once did in the Brecon Beacons. And Mary, I say as soon as I get a chance, what's she like? Do I need to be worried? Old girlfriend and all that? Ha ha! I try unsuccessfully to give an airy, natural laugh. Don't be ridiculous, snaps Dan. And there's a defensive flair to his voice that makes me stare at him in sudden, genuine fear. He clearly realizes that he's overreacted because the next moment he's looking up from his mint and smiling like any loving husband would and saying, I don't worry about you seeing Nick Reese every day, do I? I keep on smiling, but inside I'm seething. Nick Reese is a totally different case. Yes, he is my ex-boyfriend, and yes, I run into him a fair amount. But that's because he has a daughter in the girls' class at school. I run into him at school events because I have to. Not because I've invited him to my house for a special Ottolenghi dinner and taken special care over my outfit. Yes, I have noticed that Dan's wearing his nicest, most flattering shirt. I have noticed. I just wondered what she was like, I shrug casually. Oh, she's... Dan pauses, and his eyes become distant. She's a life enhancer. She's wise, calm. Some people just have that quality, you know? A kind of goodness, a kind of down-to-earth, soothing... She's like a tranquil lake. I stare at him, stricken. Mary's a tranquil lake. Whereas I'm what? Some burbling, frantic river with white water rapids round every corner. Is he simply tired of me? Does he want a lake, not a river? Is that the massive great chasm in our marriage that I can't see? Tears suddenly prick my eyes again, and I look away. I have to get a grip. What would Tilda say? She'd say, stop overthinking, you silly idiot, and have a glass of wine. I'm having a glass of wine, I say, opening the fridge. You want one? I'll just finish this mint, says Dan, glancing at his watch. They'll be here soon. I pour myself a glass of Sauvignon Blanc and check the table, trying to calm myself down. And as I walk round, straightening napkins that didn't need to be straightened, something new occurs to me. I've been focusing entirely on him. What about her? From her photo, she looks like a good person. She looks like a person who wouldn't steal her friend's husband. So maybe my best bet is to become her friend. Bond with her. Show her that I'm a really nice person. Show her that even if Dan says, my wife doesn't understand me, which, to be fair, sometimes I don't, I'm still doing my best. I mean... He is quite hard to understand, in my defense. That mania he has about turning radiators down, I will never get that. I'm just telling myself that this is a good strategy, and there's no need to be anxious. When the doorbell rings and I start so hard, my Sauvignon Blanc nearly spills out of my glass. She's here, I say shrilly. I mean, they're here. Someone's here. Dan goes to get the front door, and I soon hear the boom of cheery male voices from the hall. Adrian! Jeremy, long time, come on in, Dan is saying, and my heart unclenches a little. It's not her, not yet. I look up with a smile as Adrian and Jeremy appear, both standard-issue nice guys with stubbly beards. Adrian has glasses, Jeremy has red suede shoes, and apart from that, I can't really tell the difference. Dan pours drinks and hands round crisps, while I half listen to their conversation, which is all about people I've never even heard of. And then... They're on to Mary. She works for an environmental consultancy, Adrian is saying. That makes sense. I can't think how we all lost touch, Dan shakes his head. Have you been back to the garden? A few times, Jeremy nods. You know, he breaks off as the doorbell rings, and I swear a frisson runs through every one of us. It's her. It's Mary. Right, says Dan. And I can tell he's keyed up from his voice. Well, that must be her. I'll just go and... Is he deliberately avoiding my eye as he heads out to the hall? I can't tell. I top up everyone's glass with wine, especially my own. I think we're going to need it. And then suddenly, there she is, coming into the kitchen with Dan, and my heart plummets. She's a vision. An absolute vision. Taller than I expected. All cloudy dark hair and kind eyes and those amazing dimples. Hello, she says with a radiant smile and extends a hand. Sylvie? I'm Mary. I blink at her, feeling overwhelmed. She's gorgeous. She really does look like an angel in a white shirt with an oversized collar and soft linen trousers. Hi, I clasp her hand and shake it. Yes, I'm Dan's wife. You're so sweet to have us all over, says Mary, then adds to Dan, Oh, white wine, please. What a treat. Jeremy, Adrian, you both look wonderful. She has that gift of putting people at their ease. I instantly realize. I glance downward and see that she's wearing amazing grey leather pumps, which manage to look fashionable and ethical and expensive, but non-showy, all at the same time. I'm in the slingback kitten heels I always wear for supper parties. I liked them 10 minutes ago, but they suddenly seem really obvious and inferior. I love your kitchen, says Mary in her soft voice. It has a wonderful family atmosphere. And that blue is stunning. Did you choose that? She has the most soothing voice. She really is a tranquil lake. Oh, God, I think I have a crush on this woman. Never mind Dan. We tried loads of different blues before we got it right, I say, and her face breaks into another dimpled smile. I can imagine. And look at your garden. Those adorable Wendy houses. She heads toward the back door to peer out, and I'm struck by her supple walk. She's not skinny, but she possesses her body perfectly. I can just imagine her aged 19, her pre-Raphaelite hair around her shoulders, her skin pale and perfect. No, stop it. I need to bond with her. I'll talk about gardening. Come out and see, I say, opening the back door and ushering her out onto the tiny patio. I mean, we don't do much with it. Do you have a boyfriend? Oh, God, that just popped out before I could stop it. Did that sound unnatural? No, it's fine. It's a normal question. It's what you do when you meet people. You ask them about themselves. No. Mary's face twists into a rueful expression, and she wanders over to look at our sole tree, a silver birch. Not for a while. Ah, I try to sound understanding, like a member of the sisterhood, not like the suspicious wife who's mentally logging, no boyfriend. Men can let you down so badly, Mary continues in her melodious voice. Or maybe it's just the men I've come across. They seem to have an extra capacity for deceit. This is lovely, she adds, stroking the tree. She has picked the one thing in our garden you could describe as lovely. And yarrow, she exclaims, reaching for some nondescript plant I've never even noticed. Gorgeous. So healing. Do you ever use it in your bath? No, I admit. Use that scraggy plant in my bath. Never let anyone tell you that it's a weed. You can make a wonderful tincture with the flowers. It helps with sleep, fevers, everything. She looks up, her eyes shining, and I stare back, slightly mesmerized. It's one of my passions. Natural healing. And energy healing. Energy healing? Using the body's own energy to rebalance. Mary gives me her beatific smile again. I'm only a beginner, but I believe passionately in the mind-body connection, in the flow. She gestures down her body in one beautiful movement. Here you are, Dan's voice interrupts us, and we both turn to see him stepping out of the back door. What are you two gossiping about? He sounds self-conscious, I instantly register. Too hearty. Sylvie was asking me about my love life, says Mary with that same rueful expression, and I see Dan's gaze dart to me sharply. Great. So now it looks like I've led Mary outside, away from the group, to demand if she's single. Which is totally not what I did. I mean, it's not what I meant to do. It just came up. I wasn't, I say a little shrilly. I mean, who cares about that? I attempt to laugh, which doesn't quite come off. Anyway, tell Dan about your natural healing, Mary. It sounds amazing. Okay, so I'm being a bit Machiavellian here. If I had to vote for person least into alternative medicine, it would be Dan, by a million miles. His view on medicine is basically, take paracetamol and see your GP if you really must. He doesn't take vitamins, he doesn't meditate, and he thinks homeopathy is a massive con trick. So, what I'm hoping as we sit down to dinner is that as Mary talks about mind-body flow and clearing energy blockages, Dan will adopt his usual cynical stance, and the two will end up arguing, or at least disagreeing. Dream scenario, Mary stomping out of the house shouting, "How dare you say Reiki is all a load of bollocks?" But it doesn't happen like that. As Dan doles out the lamb, Mary tells us about her healing in such an intelligence-compelling way that we all listen, riveted. She sounds like a Shakespearean actress. She even looks like one. I start to think maybe there is something in healing after all, and even Dan seems quite open-minded. Then she moves on to yoga and teaches us all a shoulder stretch at the table. And then she tells funny stories about going on a herbalism course and making some kind of beech leaf liqueur and everyone getting totally drunk. She's not just angelic. She's sassy. She exudes positive energy. Everyone is charmed. I'm charmed. I want her to be my friend. As the evening progresses, I find myself relaxing. My fears seem to float away. There's no special vibe between her and Dan that I can make out. Dan has relaxed too, and he seems just as interested in catching up with Jeremy and Adrian as he does in Mary. By the time we're on to the green and black chocolates, I'm thinking, we must do this again. And what nice new friends. And I'll ask Mary where she got those grey pumps. I'm just pouring out fresh mint tea when I realize that a shrill voice is calling for me.
Mummy! Mummy!
I excuse myself and find Anna standing on the stairs, clutching the banisters, her face wet with tears, telling me,
"It was coming after me. It was coming. It was coming."
Poor Anna. She always takes ages to calm after a nightmare. And so I settle down to a good 20 minutes of sitting on her bed, soothing, patting, singing, and talking in a low voice. She seems to drift off, then opens her eyes again in panic and searches for me. Then drifts off again, then opens her eyes again, and I just sit there, patiently waiting. And at last, she's truly asleep, her breaths coming deeply, her fingers still clutching the edge of her duvet. I feel tempted to climb in with her. I'm suddenly quite shattered. But after all, we still have guests, and those green and black chocolates won't hand themselves round. So at last I get to my feet and head out of her room, and freeze dead. From where I'm standing on the landing, I have a view into the mirror in the hall, and in that mirror I can see the sitting room reflected. And in the sitting room are Dan and Mary. Just them. They must have no idea I can see them, that anyone can see them. They're alone, and standing close together. Mary's listening to Dan, her head tilted, with an intent, understanding expression. He's talking softly to her, so softly I can't hear his actual words. I can pick up on the vibe between them, though. It's a vibe of closeness, of familiarity, of everything I was afraid of. For a few moments, I'm motionless, my thoughts lurching this way and that. I want to confront them. No, I can't face confronting them. I might be wrong. Wrong about what, anyway? What do I imagine is happening? Might they not just be two old friends, sharing a moment? But why hide away from everyone? A burst of male laughter from the kitchen brings me to, and automatically I start walking forward. I can't stay upstairs forever. As I head downstairs, the stairs creak, and at once Dan appears at the sitting room door. "Sylvie!" he exclaims too loudly. "I was just showing Mary..." He trails off as though unable to think of a convincing story. Then Mary appears in the doorway, and the look she gives me makes me feel chilled. It's unmistakable. It's a look of pity. For a moment our eyes are locked, and I swallow, my throat tight, unable to speak. "Actually, I must be going," says Mary in that soft voice. "Already?" says Dan. But he doesn't sound too sorry. And as we head back into the kitchen, the other two are also standing up, talking about tubes and Ubers, and thanking us for a wonderful time. This evening has got away from me. I wanted to slow down, press pause. I need to gather my thoughts. But before I have a chance to, we're in the hall, finding everyone's coats and exchanging kisses. Mary won't look me in the eye. I'm desperate to pull her aside and ask, "What were you talking to Dan about just now?" And, "Why did you two go off like that?" But I'm not brave enough. Am I?
"Mummy! I woked up!"
Tessa's shrill voice interrupts my thoughts, and my heart sinks.
"Tessa! Not you too!"
I hurry upstairs, instinctively scooping her back before she decides to join in the party. Children being out of bed is like the 5-second rule. You have to be swift. I bundle her back into bed and sit there until she's closed her eyes, listening to all the final goodbyes below in the hall and the front door closing. When Tessa is gently snoring, I creep back out onto the landing, and I'm about to head downstairs when something stops me, something hard and splintery and suspicious. Instead, I move silently into the bathroom, which overlooks the front of the house, and peep out. Dan and Mary are on the pavement, talking. Just the two of them. How did I know they would be there? I just knew. There's a horrible squeezing feeling in my chest as I crouch down by the window and silently open it a crack. Mary has wrapped herself up in a pashmina, and her face under the streetlight is wreathed with concern. I lean my head against the windowsill, trying desperately to pick up scraps of conversation.
"Now you understand," Dan is saying in a low voice. "I just feel pinned in a corner."
My throat tightens in shock. Pinned in a corner? He feels pinned in a corner?
"Yes, I get it,"
Mary is saying.
"I do. I just..."
Their voices descend lower, and I can only pick out the odd word.
"Talk. Find out.
She won't.
Be careful."
My heart is thudding as I peep out of the window again to see that Mary is clasping Dan in a hug. A tight hug. A passionate hug. I sink back on my heels. I feel faint. Dark shapes are scudding across my brain. Am I the ultimate trusting fool? Were the pair of them playing me all evening? I'm rerunning Mary's friendly, charming air, her soft voice, the hand she kept putting on my arm. Was it all an act? "Men have an extra capacity for deceit," she said. And now I remember the look she gave me. Was that a hint? A warning? I hear the front door closing and hastily come out of the bathroom to see Dan in the hall, staring up at me. There are shadows on his face, and I can't read his expression, and all I can think is, he feels pinned in a corner.
"You go to bed," he says. "I'll just stack a few plates. We can do the rest tomorrow."
Normally I'd say, "Don't be silly, I'll help,"
and we'd clear away companionably and pick over the evening and start laughing over something or other. Not tonight. I get ready for bed feeling a bit numb, and I'm still lying there, totally rigid, wondering what on earth I do next. How on earth I proceed. When Dan finally gets in beside me.
"Well, that went well," he says.
"Yes,"
somehow I manage to speak.
"The lamb was delicious."
"They're a fun crowd."
"Yes."
There's another long, weird silence. Then Dan suddenly says,
"Oh, I need to send an email. Sorry."
He gets out of bed and pads out of the room in his bare feet, and for 10 seconds I lie still, my mind trying to self-soothe. Dan is always sending emails. He's always getting out of bed with some late-night thought. He's a busy man. It doesn't mean anything. It really doesn't mean anything. But I can't help it. My suspicion is like a desperate hunger. I have to obey it. Without making a sound, I swing my legs round, stand up and move silently to the door of our bedroom. The door of Dan's study is open, and the light is on. I lean forward, noiselessly, until I glimpse him, and feel another profound shock.
He's standing in his study, tapping away on a phone I've never seen before. A Samsung. What's that phone?
Why does he need two phones?
As I watch, he drops it into a drawer and locks it with a little key. It's on the same key ring as his house keys. I never even knew he had that little key. I didn't know he kept a drawer of his desk locked. Why does he need to lock a drawer? What's he hiding from me? What? For a few moments, we're both motionless. Dan seems transfixed by his thoughts. I'm transfixed by Dan. Then he suddenly turns, and in fright I leap backward, skittering silently away. I'm back in bed within 10 seconds, the duvet pulled right over me, my heart banging furiously.
Everything okay?
I ask, as he gets back into bed.
Oh, fine.
And I don't know if it's my desperate optimism surfacing or my belief in giving everyone a fair chance, but I can't rest until I've given him an opportunity to make this all okay again.
Dan, listen.
I prod his shoulder until he turns, his face all tired and ready for sleepish.
Seriously, is everything all right?
Please, you look so stressed. If there's anything wrong or worrying you,
I mean, you would tell me, wouldn't you? You're not ill, are you?
I say with a gasp of horror. Because if you were, tears have started to my eyes. For God's sake, I'm a nervous wreck.
Of course I'm not ill, he stares at me. Why would I be ill?
Because you seem so...
I trail away desperately.
Because you were hugging Mary? Because you're hiding something? Because you feel pinned in a corner? Because I don't know what to think.
I gaze at him, silently, willing him to see the words in my eyes, to react, to feel my pain. I thought we were psychic. I thought he would pick up on my every fear and reassure me. But he seems impervious.
I'm fine, he says shortly. It's all good. Let's get some sleep.
He turns over, and within moments he's breathing the heavy, regular breaths of someone who was so tired they couldn't hang about being awake any longer. But I don't. I lie awake, staring at the ceiling, my resolve hardening, because I know what I'm going to do now. I know exactly what I'm going to do. Tomorrow, I'm going to steal his keys. Chapter 13. I've never stolen anything before. I feel so guilty, I don't know what to do with myself. I swiped Dan's keys while he was in the shower and put them at the back of my underwear drawer. Now I'm hovering round the kitchen, wiping things that don't need wiping, talking to the girls in a false high-pitched voice, and dropping spoons every 5 minutes.
Where are my keys? Dan comes scowling into the kitchen. They aren't anywhere. Tessa? Anna? Have you taken Daddy's keys?
Of course they haven't, I exclaimed defensively. You probably just misplaced them. Have you checked your jacket pockets?
I turn hastily away before he can see the telltale blush in my cheeks. I would so not make an arch criminal.
I had them, Dan is rummaging through the fruit bowl. I had them.
Yes, but we were all distracted by the guests, weren't we?
I say, deftly inserting a plausible reason for him to have lost them.
Just use your spares for now. I'm sure your proper set will turn up.
I'm not using my spares, says Dan in horror. I need to find my keys.
It's only for now, I say soothingly. Look, here are your spares in the cupboard.
I double-check the spares before I pinched his proper keys, so in some ways I would make a good arch-criminal. I can see Dan is torn between two huge yet opposing principles. Never admit defeat when something's lost, and don't be late for work. At last, making an impatient noise, he grabs the spares. Between us, we chivvy the girls into their school sweatshirts and check their book bags, and at last all three of them are out of the house. As Dan is closing the car door, I call out, "I'll have another look for your keys before I leave," which is a genius stroke because, one, if Dan unexpectedly returns, it explains why I'm in his study. Two, it deflects suspicion away from me. And three, I can now find them and leave them on the kitchen table. Job done.
Let's face it, I would make an excellent arch-criminal.
I watch as the car pulls away. I wait another 5 minutes, just in case.